the matter of State versus...
It's Deje, Your Honor.
Thank you. Deje Cobiello, may we please have appearances?
May it please the Court, Your Honor, my name is John Menzel, appearing on behalf of Ms. Cobiello.
Oleg Nekrutin for Robert DeGroot, on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Munir Shiraz Dean, Assistant Ocean County Prosecutor, on behalf of the State.
May this Court, David M. Kaler, on behalf of the New Jersey Motor Vehicle Commission.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Menzel, please go ahead.
This is a pretty straightforward question. You could have knocked me over with a feather when certification was granted. But it's a basic question that I think really deserves this court's attention to provide guidance to the courts below. This was a motion for credit against a sentencing component from the second offense DUI. I don't know how it became an administrative question. There's a clear distinction. The interlock requirement has always been characterized as a penalty by the statutes. It's a component of sentencing. It is clearly part of the punishments that courts are required to impose in some form. So the application, at least in my mind, was naturally to be to the sentencing judge, Judge Daniels. It's not an administrative question. Ms. Cobiello is going to deal with a lot of administrative hurdles with the Motor Vehicle Commission, but they have nothing to do with the interlock requirement. She's going to have to take the driving test again. She's going to have to take the written test. She's taking care of the surcharges. That's an administrative requirement. And as far as the administrative authority delegated to the IDRC, she satisfied that. This thing she's dealing with now is the sentence. And so the question is, should be to the sentencing court. And that's it in a nutshell. You were so kind to grant me the opportunity to give a reply. You know all of my arguments. I'll be happy to entertain any questions you have.
So the state argues that there was no discretion prior to 2019. How do you respond to that?
No discretion for...
I claim you couldn't wait out the penalty. There was no discretion to address it in the way that the 2019 amendment has done.
Well, that's a question I thought would have been put to the trial judge that would deal with and reviewed. But if to go there, Judge, I think they do have the discretion. If you look at the way that statute was written prior to 2019, the legislature completely forgot that there was a class of people who would be so poor and unable to own cars or just financially afford them, that, as I argued below, it could be construed in such a way as to analogize to substituting jail for fines, now community service for fines. It could be analogized that very easily. Even as the statute exists now, after December 1st, 2019, the argument that on the merits is one. Maybe the legislature filled in the hole by suggesting you could replace interlock with revocation, but I've read that statute over and over. I'm waiting for that question to come up. I don't know if that statute, I think it's going to have to be construed. And it may be something that a trial judge will deal with. But as I viewed our issue here, it was purely jurisdictional. And I'd love to address the other merits questions if you want. But I do think... judges below should have that inherent discretion to deal with a disenfranchised class of people.
So when you just say discretion, you're not arguing that your client, as a matter of law, is entitled to have her time without operating a vehicle count toward the interlock period. You're arguing that in the appropriate forum, she should be able to seek a discretionary decision that would, in full or in part, do that.
But sure.
You're not arguing as a matter of entitlement. The statute means if you choose not to drive, you automatically get this.
No, the trial judges should be able to view each individual defendant and their circumstances. You may have to make a financial showing. If there's an ability financially to purchase a vehicle or something like that, or a showing that maybe you can't afford the vehicle, but there's a job opportunity available, like driving for Amazon or delivering pizza or something like that, you know, that's what discretion's all about, is looking at all of the factors and considering them and weighing them and making a decision.
But here, didn't the trial court first, so first they say, you know, this should be a decision for the chief administrator and not for the court. So I'm with you there that that's about jurisdiction. But then doesn't the trial court go on and say that the defendant was not entitled to credit because one cannot choose to serve a longer driving license revocation as a substitute sentence for the interlock installation? The time with the interlock is designed for imposition after the driver is restored. The purpose of the statute is not simply to avoid driving.
I understand that dicta. But again, the problem devolves back to the way the legislature wrote the statute, how pre-2019 they have completely ignored a class of people, whereas post-2019 there's an ambiguous statute now that suggests that that driving privilege forfeiture is a substitute for interlock. That's the merits question that I think has to be dealt with below.
In terms of the argument that the legislature just ignored this or forgot about this, the statute at the time did say, you know, that the court shall order this device to be installed. And then it says the device shall remain installed for not less than 1 year or more than 3 years, commencing immediately upon the return of the offender's driver's license after the required period of suspension has been served. So doesn't the plain language of the statute thus require installation of the device after the person's license is returned?
Under the old statute, that's correct. The new statute, it depends whether they're first, second, or third, just permutations under the new statute.
But you don't argue that the new statute applies here, right? Everyone is conceding that it's the version that was in effect in 2014 that applies?
Yeah, we're dealing with the old statute, but the fact of the matter is I think the question still can come up under the new statutory scheme.
So what's the statutory basis for the relief under the old statutes?
Well, listen, that's why, you know, you think in terms of what do courts like to do. They like to stay away from constitutional questions if they can. That's why I argued below a statutory interpretation, because the fact of the matter is this court has, in fact, changed statutes or accounted for things the legislature forgot as a matter of statutory interpretation. And my suggestion to the court below, given the fact that the legislature completely forgot about poor people, is that there has to be some other constitutional remedy, even without getting to the issue of equal protection. That's why I suggested that it could be a matter of interpretation. I remember when we were arguing about the refusal statute, how the statute still says you find refusals by a preponderance of the evidence. Well, this court changed that and made it beyond a reasonable doubt. Legislature still hasn't acted, but this court did affect the statutory law. And is there statutory authority pre-2019 for what I've been asking? I think it's just missing. It's a black hole. There should have been something there. And maybe the legislature saw that and added that paragraph, 450.18, to substitute revocation for interlock.
Could there be an impossibility aspect to it? If a defendant, maybe not yours, doesn't possess a car, own a car, what are you installing it in? At that
exactly.
Point?
Exactly. I'm going to remember that word, though. I got to put it in for the brief. But it is, you know, the problem is this. You really are, you know, my client is indigent. She's got her mental issues. She'd like to try to get back in the workforce. And she can't. And if we interpret it the way the state wants us to interpret it, she's going to be condemned to being a pedestrian or to the trains or the buses. And she's not going to have the normal opportunities that a citizen would have. She's not a criminal. She's I guess you call it what we call a scofflaw when you're a traffic offender. But she's being treated as if she's a criminal. At least she can vote, but she just can't drive.
Are you saying that your client still doesn't have any access to a vehicle on which the device could be installed?
Not legally. She doesn't own a car, doesn't have the wherewithal to buy a car. I mean, the facts have not changed.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
It's been a pleasure. I see all these new faces. Well, you're not so new. But It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully not from a nightmare.
Last time I saw you was downstairs, but, you know, I should have done this at the outset, but I would like to reserve maybe a minute for rebuttal if it's needed.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Nekritin.
Your Honors, the ACDL, most of our clients, or the lawyers who compose the ACDL, most of our clients are individuals who are working class people or who are part of the working poor. They need an automobile. They need an automobile to get to work. They need an automobile to pick up their kids. In this market, it's difficult for them to obtain an automobile. Used car prices, just watching the news, are really high. If they're lucky to have an automobile, they're able to use it to make ends meet. I read a statistic today that according to the United Way, 30% of people who reside in New Jersey live paycheck to paycheck. So although upon first blush, this case may not present an issue of constitutional significance because we look at it from the perspective of, well, it's only $200 to install an interlock device and then $200 a month subsequently later on to keep the interlock device in the car and operating. That $400 is, for many people in our state, the difference between being able to afford to pay for rent, to pay for daycare expenses, to pay for car insurance, even to make a monthly car payment. So for a substantial amount of people in this state, the issue of credits towards the interlock, towards the ignition interlock device is a significant issue. And that's why I think the court granted this certification. The issue before this court is who is in a better position to decide if credit should be assigned. Should it be the Motor Vehicle Commission, or should it be the courts? My experience with clients accused of criminal acts, clients who are before the municipal courts, is that there is an inherent respect for the bench, an inherent respect for the judiciary, because it is the only branch where you are required to be objective and impartial. If there's ever a controversy, people always say, well, let's take it to court, because there is a confidence in the court system. I thought the Attorney General's office was very candid in the way it described the functions of the Motor Vehicle Commission. It's ministerial. It's basically having a checklist and seeing if an individual now qualifies to get his driver's license. As Mr. Manziel explained, sometimes the facts in life are not so easy. They don't fit a checklist. They require the exercise of discretion. And that's why it's important for this court to rule that our courts should be the ones exercising that discretion. It's not checklist justice. And we look at the law, and I know there were issues posed to Mr. Manziel about, well, this case stems from prior to 2019, prior to the enactment of new legislation, but I think it's reasonable to assume that there are a lot of people who had their driver's licenses suspended prior to 2019 who have had issues with drug addiction or fell on hard times and who have not been able to obtain a car and to drive. Hopefully, by the grace of God or through their hard work, they're going to be able to obtain an automobile. They're going to be able to potentially get their driver's licenses back. And that extra $400 a month for those people, it'll make an effect on their lives. And
about a cost per month, but I thought we were talking about having access to a car in which to install the device. Are you asking the court to change the statute about a reduced fee?
No. There's going to be issues before this court of individuals who were suspended prior to 2019 who would otherwise qualify to drive, but they can't unless they get an interlock device installed, and they may not have the financial resources to pay for the interlock device.
But the statute did all along outline requirements for people to be able to install the the device for a reduced fee, right?
Yes, but it's still, it's
That's not this case. This case is about a totally different issue. Right?
Right, but this is a reason for why this court should look at the case in terms of permitting the court to exercise discretion, because a lot of these individuals, they just don't have the resources. We look at cases
to get a car,
to get an interlock device.
That's not before the court. And if you're asking for the court to rule on whether or not it's appropriate for someone who has a car to be able to get out from under the requirement of installing an interlock, that's not the issue here.
No, it's as to the assignment of credits, but the practical effect is that an individual, if they're provided credits against the installation of the interlock device, they will have to pay less money for that, as in the case of Mr. Manzal's client.
Can you just clarify this line of argument? You're asking the court to allow for credits to be made available in cases where individuals can't afford to buy or rent a car, and in addition to afford credits in other situations?
No, Judge. I'm just talking about the practical real-life consequences of the court's decision.
We understand that.
Sure.
Help us. Tell us what it is that you're asking the court to do.
To permit the municipal court or whichever court has the controversy before it to award credits against the installation of the interlock device.
In what circumstances? When the person doesn't have a car, or broader circumstances?
If a person doesn't have a car is one such example.
Are you asking for relief in situations where a person has the means to own or lease a car?
No, Your Honor. That's why we look at that's why we look at discretion. The new statute, I believe, permits an individual who does
pre-2019.
Sure.
The legal issue that's in front of us, you're only asking for the relief that your colleague, Mr. Manzal, has requested?
Yes.
Okay.
So how would the municipal court judge establish that fact that somebody cannot own or lease a car? Take me through it practically.
Practically, I think the individual's lawyer would just submit a certification detailing the income that the defendant makes, his or her resources, what assets they may have. It's similar to an individual who's asking for a public defender.
So no ability to pay hearing, no opportunity to challenge or test value of the affidavit?
Judge, it's an issue that generally wouldn't take that much time. It's just, if you have any pay stubs, attach the pay stubs. If you're unemployed, provide proof you're unemployed and you're receiving unemployment benefits.
It sounds similar to this process that the statute now provides for post-2019, but where in the statute before 2019 do we find any discretion?
Piggybacking on Mr. Manzal's argument, there's nothing there, but perhaps the reason why there's nothing there is because the legislature just couldn't conceive of this fact pattern. That does happen, and that's why we look for the bench to exercise its discretion. And
but generally, unless there's a constitutional issue, and we do not second-guess the judgments of the legislature, even if we don't think we may conclude that there's an oversight or they didn't think of a situation. That's really their, under separation of powers doctrine, that's their function, is it not?
It is, Your Honor, but if there's a hole and there's no direction and an issue keeps coming up before the courts, I think, as Mr. Manzal stated, the courts have a duty and obligation to interpret the statute in such a way that I think they believe that the legislature would
would, if it had a chance to do?
Yeah.
Can we clarify which court we're talking about? Because Mr. Manzal's client was in the law division, the criminal part.
Yes.
And you've mentioned the municipal court. So where should these cases, if you know, to the extent they exist,
Generally, where should they go? Generally, it would be the municipal courts because that's where DWI matters are heard. Mr. Manzal's case was atypical in that his client was first charged with an indictable offenses. And he resolved his matter by pleading guilty to a DP, and along with the DP, the traffic offense. But generally, they would be before the municipal courts.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Kaler.
Good May it please the court, the question presented today was where a portion of a defendant's sentence for driving while intoxicated requires the installation of an interlock, ignition interlock device, should a request for credit toward that portion of a sentence be heard by a court or the Motor Vehicle Commission? I respectfully submit on behalf of the Motor Vehicle Commission, the answer to that question is that the question should be answered by the courts. And the commission will rely on the arguments it made in its brief, unless the court has any further questions for me.
Which court? The municipal court or the law division or both, or where should it
be? The commission, we don't have a position on that. I think the main message that we'd like to convey today is that this is not a question for the commission. And which court it ends up in specifically is no issue to the commission.
The Administrative Procedure Act has a provision that permits administrative agencies to issue declaratory relief in some circumstances concerning the applicability of a statute. Now, the county prosecutor, representing the state in some other way here, has asserted that what Mr. Menzel and his client are looking for here is essentially in the nature of a declaratory ruling. Is it beyond the authority of the MVC to issue a declaratory ruling in a case like this to conclude or assert or find that the time spent by the defendant here without a car qualifies to meet the requirements of the statute? The MVC have any declaratory authority under the APA to do that?
So to be candid, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the specific declaratory action that you're referring to, but I can say if this question had been presented to the Motor Vehicle Commission, assuming all the facts are the same, the response would have been that the Motor Vehicle Commission does not have jurisdiction to rule on this matter because it's for the courts to decide.
The prosecutor takes a position that had defendant gone to your client, the MVC, seeking license restoration and been turned down, she could have gone through NJAC 129-1.1 for administrative relief, and that was the path she should have taken. Do you have a position, or does your client have a position on whether or not that's correct?
Well, it's essentially, I think, the same answer to Judge Sabatino's question, in that had the question presented to the commission would have declined to rule on the merits, finding that it's a decision for the courts. Now, if that initial decision were made by the commission and the petitioner wanted to go through the commission's appeal process,
mm-hmm. It could have eventually ended up in the appellate division.
Yes. But that wouldn't change the commission's position on who ought to be hearing this question.
So we understand who you think should hear this. Tell us what your view is of the court's authority. The basis for the court to act.
Right. Your Honor, we have no position on the court's authority either. Again, this is because we perceive this to be a question for the court, the commission sees no reason to weigh in on that question.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, thank you for your time.
Mr. Dean.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this case involves a defendant seeking to avoid a mandatory sentence by conflating the judiciary's power to impose a sentence with the executive branch's power to enforce it. They seek to effect this scheme by empowering the sentencing court to step into the role of the MVC and make a determination as to whether this defendant satisfied the sentence that was imposed by that very sentencing court. The state has four major categories of arguments against this procedure, namely that it is unnecessary, impractical, illegal, and unconstitutional. And I'd like first, I think it makes logical sense to first discuss whether or not this is necessary. And I think to do that, ultimately, we have to focus on what is the relief that this defendant is seeking. And I think we can all agree it is restoration of her driver's license. But critically, there is no record below of this defendant having ever applied for that said restoration. And if the MVC were to grant that application, then the issue would be moot before every court and agency to consider it. Quite simply, this issue is premature. The MVC should be the agency by which evaluating this issue, because if we allow what happened below to have a sentencing court issue a decision not in review, but essentially in parallel to the MVC, what we're essentially is open to exposing the judiciary to issuing moot or even conflicting opinions. And let's say the court were to have, at the time of this motion, granted the application for the driver's license restoration and the MVC were to deny it. Which agency's decision would control? Well, the legislature seems to have bestowed authority over this issue to the MVC. The court has no statutory, constitutional, or procedural authority to rule on this issue whatsoever, and in fact is completely disengaged from this process but for the filing of this novel motion before it. And the question which no party has yet to answer is, why are we creating a new forum when agency appeal exists? What makes this situation so unique that we are required to construct a completely new tribunal in a different branch of government to assess something that can be addressed within the administrative appeal process? And I think that's significant, particularly because there are constitutional questions as to whether or not a court has the authority to again seize executive authority and make this ruling. And I do say seize executive authority because what the defense is asking for is a sentence credit. And no one has really discussed where this concept comes from. What is a sentence credit? And the only allusion to the source of the court having the authority to issue such a sentence credit is an allusion to the jail credit statute. But let's think about this critically. Is what the defense asking for in the same nature as a jail credit? State would say absolutely not. I think they deliberately use the term sentence credit to evoke this, which is obviously courts have the authority to issue jail credits. But critically, jail credits are circumscribed and mandated by court rule. They're very narrowly tailored. And most importantly, they govern pre-sentence custody while the court still retains jurisdiction over the case. Show me one case where a court is allowed to issue jail credit based on time spent in a Department of Corrections facility post-sentence. It doesn't exist. What does exist is State v. Beauchamp, which the state block quoted in its brief to the appellate division, which the appellate division block quoted, because it represents an important constitutional distinction. Once the judiciary imposes its sentence, it relinquishes jurisdiction over to the executive branch to enforce that sentence. And what is a sentence credit as the defense envisions it? It is enforcement of that sentence. It is a determination that this defendant's actions and circumstances were such that she satisfied the sentence that the very court imposed. So based on that formulation, we're asking the court to essentially use Rule 794 as a means to lionize the judiciary, to seize jurisdiction, to seize executive authority, and determine that this sentence was satisfied and that the MVC's role is to passively accept whatever determination that the sentencing court makes based on that motion.
Since you're talking all about the MVC's authority and the MVC's role, don't we have to pay attention to the MVC's view that it does not have jurisdiction here?
Your Honor, certainly we do, but the state, and I don't want to put words in my colleague's mouth, but the state is under the impression that the MVC misinterpreted the appellate division decision. I think they were scared that the appellate division decision, and I think we see this clearly in their brief, mandated that they were required to conduct the sorts of hearings that were conducted below in this case. That's why they responded and said, well, this is really just a procedural thing that we do, a very perfunctory process where we go through a series of checkboxes. They're not equipped to handle the sorts of substantive court hearings that took place below, but that is not what the appellate division said. The appellate division and the trial court both are in agreement. They just said that this is a matter within the authority of the Motor Vehicle Commission. And I think the implication there, even though they didn't directly state it, was that anybody seeking to challenge that authority, challenge a decision made by that executive branch agency, should go through the usual agency appeal process, just like anybody challenging a final decision as set forth in Rule 2:2-3, or whatever the...
Mr. Dean, you have the Motor Vehicles Commission, an executive agency, the Attorney General, an executive, a part of the executive, coming to this court and saying, this belongs in the courts. Can you explain how that involves the courts lionizing themselves or seizing executive authority?
I think even if there was agreement between the executive and judiciary, we still have to take into account basic principles of separation of powers.
Indeed we do. I'm asking about the choice of language that you've been using. What about this case demonstrates an attempt at lionizing or seizing authority by the judiciary?
I would say it's abdication, maybe, and that's the term that the state used in its brief. We're talking about the MVC essentially abdicating the issue to the judicial branch. And are they entitled to do that? Well, no. The state cited to a number of cases in its brief regarding the separation of powers concept of one branch completely. Even if they want to, they cannot abdicate complete control of something, particularly when the legislature mandated that they are the agency required to decide this issue.
What deference is due their judgment?
I think we consider I don't know that there's any deference involved the constitutional question. They don't have the authority to trample upon their constitutional rights and their statutorily mandated duties. If they don't wish to do that, that's certainly something the court can take into account. But I don't think the reasoning that they've espoused in support of their position is logically sound.
You're saying we don't defer at all to an agency's view of its own jurisdiction?
I think the Constitution and the statute the constitutional and legislative bodies that control in this situation. If an agency doesn't believe that it has a duty that has been statutorily mandated to do, I don't think we could pay that any deference. I think we have
then
to look at the statute.
Then where in the statute does it specifically say that the MVC has this authority?
Your Honor, I would cite to the 50.18 statute, where the legislature mandated that the commission shall require that the device be installed before restoration of the person's driver's license that has been forfeited pursuant. The commissioner shall imprint the notation on the driver's license, and that saying that person shall not operate a motor vehicle unless it is equipped with an initialed interlock device, and shall enter this requirement in the person's driving record. That clearly establishes that the courts have no say in restoration of a driving license. That authority has been mandated to the MVC. And sure enough, when somebody completes their ignition interlock program, who do they go to restore their driver's license? Do they go to the court? Absolutely not. They go to the MVC, which makes a unilateral determination based on this checkbox system. Again, we don't really know what it looks like.
Play out what would happen if Ms. Coviello went to the MVC, sought restoration, hasn't done her interlock portion of her sentence. Presumably the MVC would find that the restoration was not appropriate because that portion of the sentence had not been completed. Then it goes through the administrative process in the MVC, the rest of it, the final agency decision, and then it goes to the appellate division. Is that how you would envision this all plays out?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think
then she goes to the appellate division and she says, I went through an administrative process and I can't meet this because I don't have access to a vehicle. And the appellate division is simply doing an agency review with deference to the agency and finds that under the limited authority given to the agency hasn't done anything wrong. And affirms, I'm just envisioning this possibility, and there is no relief for this individual anywhere.
Absolutely. Your Honor, this gets right to the heart of the state's contention, which is that defendant's grievance doesn't lie with enforcement of this particular statute. It lies with the very fact that this is a mandatory sentence and potentially the fact that the new statute is not retroactive. So if she is to challenge the sentence, the only means to do so is through this agency appeal process. But instead of arguing contested facts, she would make the equal protection argument that she tried to raise below. And now we have a record of the very enforcement agency who is taking an action against this defendant, preventing her from getting relief, setting forth its reasons and its decisions for upholding the statute or interpreting the statute in a way that they believe offers them no authority to provide relief.
You just said that the grievance lies with the sentence. So what if what she is trying to grieve is the sentence, wouldn't she go to the court that imposed the sentence?
The grievance is not with the sentence. The grievance is with enforcement of the sentence. I don't think anybody's contesting facially that the legislature has the authority to require an interlock device. The problem is it being applied unequally in its enforcement of that particular provision to indigent defendants? If the MVC were to create a new checkbox that says, is the defendant indigent, and recognizing the new law allows indigent defendants to simply attest to not having a license, and if defendant checks that checkbox and they grant her license back, she has no case or controversy before any court. There is no equal protection violation. The equal protection violation stems from the fact that, hypothetically, if there is one, it stems from the fact that it's being forced to the detriment of indigent defendants more so than regular litigants for arguably no purpose. Again, that's how the argument would go.
What authority does the agency have under statute to provide the sort of relief you've just described?
It would be difficult. The agency would have to recognize that the statute is not sufficient on equal protection grounds. It would basically be an argument against enforcement of the statute itself. It'd have to go to the appellate division. It'd probably have to come to this court, and this court would have to make a ruling. Is the statute as applied to indigent defendants unconstitutional and violation of equal protection laws?
So as
you read case law,
Just one follow-up. As you read the statute then, prior to 2019, an individual who lacked the means to purchase or lease or somehow come into the position of operating a vehicle could never get their license restored?
The state did address, the defense did abandon that argument on appeal, but we did address that in our appellate brief. And just briefly, the state would say that there is a public policy benefit to have a defendant, indigent or otherwise, particularly somebody who's driven drunk twice before, train their behavior on an interlock device, regardless of whether or not they are capable of obtaining a vehicle to do so. There's definitely a benefit to society. Does it outweigh the detriment to that particular defendant? Well, the legislature ultimately determined no, and that's why they amended the statute. But that would have to be the argument that the defense would have to raise in challenging the equal protection.
I'm asking a different question.
Sir?
Your understanding of the statute, could an indigent individual under the prior statute, the pre-2019 amendment, get his or her license back?
I don't think without a vehicle, I don't think they could. I think the statute is mandatory in that respect. I don't see a way that we can get around that particular provision. And what is it unconstitutional that that is the case, given that the new statute is not retroactive? That's the question for a court in a different proceeding. But I think we have to look at the Motor Vehicle Commission's decisions for interpreting the statute that way in denying a defendant a driver's license in order to have a proper record on which to make that conclusion.
To the extent that Ms. Coviello's arguments for relief are based or will be based on constitutional principles such as equal protection and due process, doesn't case law establish that when it comes to evaluating constitutionally based arguments, that courts rather than administrative agencies are the better forum for doing that?
Absolutely. And it would go to a court. It would go to the appellate division with an appeal
as
of right.
Instance.
Your Honor, I wouldn't be familiar with the entire body of case law regarding equal protection. I'll candidly concede that.
It's not about equal protection per se. It's about the suitability of the forum to evaluate a constitutional argument. I believe, my recollection may be dim about this, that there's case law that suggests or supports the idea that such arguments are best litigated in the courts rather than before an administrative tribunal.
That may be the case, Your Honor, but when we're talking about appeals from what should be a final agency administrative decision, that doesn't mean we can have a trial court sit in judgment of an executive agency making a final decision simply because it's more preferable to have that outcome.
But if the trial court is the court that imposed the sentence, and this defendant is challenging the sentence as applied to her, the constitutionality of the sentence, why wouldn't the trial court be the venue where she would be able to do that?
I think it's because what she's challenging is the application of the sentence, not the sentence itself.
She's not saying it's an illegal sentence.
Correct.
And she could go to a trial court if she had a claim that there was an illegal sentence.
Absolutely. If she thinks the trial court imposed an illegal sentence on her, absolutely, I wouldn't disagree. But that's not what she's claiming is the problem here. She's claiming that the application of the enforcement arm of the statute to prevent her from getting a driver's license is what's causing her harm. And the agency doing that is not the sentencing court. They have no involvement with that. It's the MVC in denying her application for restoration of a driver's license, which, again, we don't even know if that happened under this record, because this record did not originate from an MVC agency decision.
So what would be the, if obviously one of the main value, one of the most significant value of an agency determination is to create a full record on facts. So if this went through the agency process, the administrative process, what facts would be developed that would be of use to a court later?
I don't know to what facts she could develop as part of the equal protection argument, other than the fact that she doesn't own a vehicle and is seeking her license to be restored, and then make, it's facts or law. Again, the hearing does allow for arguments against law. She'd say that based on the facts, she should have been granted relief under these circumstances because the law is being applied unfairly to her. And the NJAC administrative code statute that I cited to in my brief does provide for that. It allows legal arguments to be considered at the hearing with the hearing agent, and then from there appeal to the appellate division as of right. So it's not as if there isn't a forum to raise these arguments. There absolutely is, but and it just makes practical sense. Which agency is better suited to hear these arguments? Is it a county prosecutor who has no knowledge of MVC enforcement, who has no control over this process, appearing in front of a sentencing judge who has no knowledge of this process, same thing, to argue this, or should it be in front of a hearing officer who is enforcing this action, who is aware of MVC rules and regulations as applied to this defendant, and the appellate division will have the ability to review the actual reasons for denial being espoused by the agency taking action against her. Without that record, how can we possibly, we can't even, the argument might even be moot, because again, the agency could change its rules or regulations at any moment and decide that they are suddenly going to start granting relief to these people. And the court ruling on this in the abstract would be making a decision that is moot if the agency were to do that. So we really do need a record of enforcement.
The agency has statutory authority, which has limits.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So do you have a position on whether if the agency suddenly decided to essentially make the 2019 amendments retroactive without saying so, and saying they had the authority, that there is authority for to give her some sort of relief, would the state consider that appropriate?
That is a question I had before coming to this hearing. I don't know that there's a resolution as to who would challenge that, really, because it is a state agency, and I don't know that there is somebody who would. But if it was to the detriment of the defendant, certainly a defendant would challenge that. Would the County Prosecutors Association or something like that challenge such a decision? I don't know. But ultimately, it would be subjective
for
somebody.
But ultimately, the direction the legislature went in was not to give the agency the ability to adjudicate this, but to provide the court has the authority.
The court has the authority at the time of sentencing, and that is critical because the legislature's statutory scheme respects the separation of powers as the state has described in its brief. They recognize that the court relinquishes jurisdiction to the MVC post-sentencing, so the only way to obtain relief for a post-sentencing change of circumstance is to file the change of sentence motion that was filed here. But whereas it's illegal under these facts, under the pre-2019, it would absolutely be an authorized disposition in the post-2019. The defendant could cert, I don't have a vehicle.
So,
she could make
so there's really nobody left out of the 2019, after the 2019 amendment. Someone who has a car at the time of sentencing but has financial difficulties and doesn't have a car when the suspension portion of the sentence is completed, can still file a motion and get the courts to exercise jurisdiction with respect to this issue under the new statute.
Absolutely. There is the change of sentence motion that the defendant envisaged here is satisfied in the post-2019 version of the statute. I don't know that there is any equal protection argument that survives the 2019 challenge. But the question is, in front of the court today, is the procedure employed for that post-2019 statutory scheme applicable in the pre-2019 statutory scheme? State would answer, it is not.
And there's been no retroactivity argument made.
Not that I have seen, Your Honor. Again, the statute was not made retroactive. The defense is certainly able to challenge that in an appeal from a motor vehicle enforcement agency action, but as they have not done so yet, and as no record has developed as of yet within that agency, I don't think that consideration of that issue is ripe at this moment. We are essentially in the situation of State v. Tormasi, where the defendant is speculating as to the future decision of an executive branch agency, and no matter how likely it is that they're going to deny relief, until they do so, no government agency has taken an action to her detriment. She essentially doesn't have standing to raise these claims today. And lastly, Your Honor, I would note that I believe that the primary argument that Amici Motor Vehicle Commission focused on in its brief as to why the court is appropriate is that they don't have the authority to remove a one-year interlock device under the old statute. They said that's an issue for the court. I think they took for granted that it doesn't necessarily the case. Again, it's not what the appellate division said, that anybody needs to have that authority. The question is, does the trial court have the authority to remove a mandatory sentence? No. Does the Motor Vehicle Commission have the authority to remove a mandatory sentence? No. Nobody does. That's not a flaw. That is a feature of mandatory sentences. If it's being applied unconstitutionally, then certainly you can challenge the law on that basis through an enforcement action agency appeal. But that is the context in which it should be raised. We have to respect the rules of procedure and separate spheres of government.
One last question, at least by me. What evidence do you have that the purpose of the interlock device, and obviously part of that is protection of the public, but is to provide a ramp back to driving status for someone in this individual's situation with multiple DWIs, in which there's an opportunity to get some practice in driving sober? Is that part of the rationale for the statute?
I think we would have to go back to the Senate floor statements when that bill was introduced. But I think logically speaking, if we look at it, I think it's certainly a more powerful tool versus license suspension. For example, if somebody's license was suspended and they're forced to not drive, take Ubers for a year, that's certainly a different behavioral training device than somebody going to the bar, having a few too many, and then being stuck realizing that they drank so many that they can't activate their car, and that happens again and again and again. I think that's a more powerful tool to change behavior than a simple license suspension. I think that's part of the reason why we installed this device. And I think that's part of the rationale that would be raised against an equal protection argument, as the legislature did have a valid rationale to impose this interlock device requirement. But again, I think that issue isn't technically in front of the court at the moment. We are concerned about jurisdiction here and whether this is the appropriate forum to consider these arguments. And I just want to say one last thing about separation of powers. The whole purpose of separation of powers is to provide a system of checks and balances against the concentration of unchecked power in one branch. Well, here we have a particularly egregious violation of separation of powers, because we're not concentrating power in just one branch of government. We're concentrating power into one person, the sentencing judge. And that person is not tethered by anything. It seems to be that the defense is arguing that he should be able to make judgments of equity in terms of establishing relief from a mandatory sentence. Now, what an Ocean County judge believes is an equitable resolution to this sort of credit argument is different than what a judge in Salem County will be. It's different from his colleague in Ocean County. So are we going to endorse a patchwork system whereby a litigant is basically entitled to forum shop between the MVC and the sentencing court? It's actually worse than forum shopping.
Why there's an appellate division to, smooth out differences, right?
Your Honor, the state cited to its brief a case which cites that the availability of appellate review does not render an arbitrary decision any less arbitrary. If the sentencing court is not tethered by any statute, any standard, any test, if it's just making decisions based on its own principles of equity, that is an arbitrary decision, and the availability of the appellate division to review that doesn't make it any less arbitrary.
The SOA calendar is there. You were probably appeared in front of it for the very reason of trying to deal with differences between vicinages and individual judges to make sure that the sentencing laws and criminal code are being administered even-handedly.
The sentencing laws and criminal code are themselves the standard by which those sentencing judges are tethered, aggravating and mitigating. The sentencing court can't make an arbitrary ruling without giving its reasons why, without tethering it to the sentencing code, without tethering it to the aggravating and mitigating. Those are the checks and balances which I think our case law have amply justified as the standard by which all sentencing judges theoretically are uniformly bound to and are evaluated by the appellate division. The appellate division has nothing to evaluate the equitability of whatever resolution sentencing courts come to on these credit questions other than their own principles of fairness. So the appellate division themselves might be divided if they're being asked to evaluate general principles of equity that aren't tethered to anything. So and I think
assume,
that...
Assume there is authority for purposes of this question. We trust a single trial judge to impose a sentence of between 30 and life, exercising the court's best judgment and discretion. But it would be unacceptable if there's authority for a judge to impose credits for an interlock device.
Yes, Your Honor, because there's no requirement for aggravating or mitigating. There's no statutory factors set forth by the legislature or in the criminal code. He's just making a decision. At least with the decision between 30 and life, you can say the aggravating circumstance is this, the mitigating circumstance is that. You can apply comparison to other cases. You can apply comparisons for those rationales to different sets of fact patterns. But here, what is the standard tethering this sentencing court's decision as to whether credits are appropriate? I think it's fair, or I think it's not fair. That's basically all there is.
You don't think it would pivot off of a determination as to whether this individual is so poor that they cannot get an interlock device for a car they don't own and they can't afford to lease?
If that was the case, then the legislature should have created a provision allowing for indigency itself to be considered as part of the totality of the circumstances or whatever test that they want. This is a matter for the legislature.
I was asking about your concern about the aggregation of power in a single individual.
Your Honor, certainly when you concentrate power like that, you can think it certainly leads to expediency. And there is an expediency and an attractiveness to allowing the court to address this sorts of inequity. But if we're not going to tether that decision, if that individual is allowed to exercise that power just based on his own inclinations of unfairness or fairness, saying that this defendant is so poor, I should be able to use my own authority, my own sympathy for this defendant to grant her relief.
Is restitution... I know I said it was my last question, but is restitution an analogous situation here? In other words, the statute provides for restitution as a component of a statute, but a court can consider the indigency of the defendant in assessing whether under an ability to pay kind of process, which takes into account the financial situation of the defendant and the ability to pay.
I think restitution is a more narrowly circumscribed penalty as opposed to something as severe as driver's license restriction. But nevertheless, it is something created by the legislature created an avenue for restitution that courts can impose. There's a body of case law based on interpreting that law.
If I remember correctly, I haven't looked it up for purposes of this case, but the legislature creates restitution as a component of the sentence, but doesn't say itself what to do if someone is indigent.
That's true, Your Honor. We do rely on the sentencing courts to make those determinations. But critically, they are grounded in some amount of reasonability. It's grounded in some amount of statutory language, at the very least. And that statutory language is critical. If we're not making interpretation of laws, what is the judiciary doing? If we have to have some sort of ground foundation for which they're going to tether their decisions. Without that, they're just acting according to their own whims. And no matter how reasonable, we can't countenance that.
I don't want to prolong this, I'm sorry. But it would also, under your jurisdictional argument, it would aggregate power with the director of the MVC. We'd have the same question about one person having a great deal of authority, as you say, untethered. It would be the same quandary, right?
Well, that is a question with regard to executive agencies in general. The power is generally aggregated into one person, but critically, executive branch agencies also apply that power uniformly. Nobody's being treated unequally in one county as opposed to another. They are allowed to exercise and make rules that are supposed to apply to all litigants who come before them, and those rules are subject to appellate review for being arbitrary, capricious, or meeting some sort of legislative purpose.
But if the MVC suddenly said, we're going to do what the 2019 amendments do and create an indigency process, would you be arguing that they went beyond their statutory authority?
I don't know that we would be doing that, to be frank.
Wouldn't be in the case.
Sorry, what was that?
Perhaps you would not be in the case.
Exactly.
Happily.
Happily. Indeed, Your Honor.
Well, in a case like this, where defendant's matter was before the law division, you are in the case.
Yeah, and that is a... That is a quirk of the situation that the defendant has conjured with respect to procedure. Again, I have no personal stake. Our office has no stake in how the MVC interprets its own rules or regulations. And yet here we are, stand before your honors, debating exactly that as if we had control over it, which we don't. This case was properly brought before an MVC agency appeal, and the fact that it wasn't is a fatal flaw to the defense's argument. So unless your honors have any questions, the state would otherwise rest.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you.
Mr. Menzel, rebuttal?
I'm trying to be as brief as I can. There's a lot to unpack here. When it comes to administrative authority, I want just your honors to recall that the language in the administrative code provision, which is 13:19-6.1, simply parrots the tail end of the statute setting forth what the penalty is. It doesn't delegate authority to the MVC to decide this question. That authority is squarely guided by Rule 7:9-4 in the municipal courts, 3:21-10 in the criminal courts. This motion is brought under 7:9-4 because of Ms. Coviello's position, albeit in the law division, is essentially being sentenced by Judge Daniels sitting as a municipal court judge. And to address your question, the mechanics really would be fairly routine. We deal with indigent defendants all the time in these courts. We have a Form 5A. It's very interesting under the modification of AOC regulations that we actually see guidelines to avoid using those forms, but those forms are available in the practices to determine indigency.
I'm confused by something. Indigency is not the same as lack of access to a car.
It's true, but it is a factor. And I know when...
But there would have to be some forum on which a determination would have to be made, even under the new statute,
certainly,
that the person lacks access to a vehicle that would preclude them from actually serving that part of their
sentence.
You're
100% right, Justice Patterson, but as Judge Sabatino noted before, we talked about exercising discretion. I mentioned indigency as one factor. Length of revocation or not having a license could be another factor. And although we didn't really address that in these briefs, this court has dealt with these kinds of questions before. And the case that comes to mind is State versus Moran, where we were talking about jail sentences in connection with reckless driving. This court is quite capable of establishing guidelines for the exercise of discretion. I don't see where it's going to be an issue here. You know, if you want to talk about guidelines on remand, that's certainly something this court can write about. But again, our question here before, and I think everybody's got a good idea of what it is what's the forum? And the forum is, it's not the municipal court, it's not the law division, it's the sentencing court, whatever court, trial court that may be. Unless you have any other questions, we've gone over our time. I want to wish you all happy holidays.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel.